hello and welcome to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. This show is going to take you on an unforgettable adventure through the silver screen. I'm your guide, Austin Reed. Join me as we delve deep into the realms of Hollywood's finest creations and hidden gems along the way. Movies have the power to transport us to incredible worlds, evoke a wide range of emotions, and ignite our imaginations like nothing else. They capture our hearts, challenge our minds, and provide us with a much-needed escape from the ordinary. Flick Fix is here to celebrate the magic of cinema, to honor the art of storytelling, and to light up a passionate flame within each and every one of you. So grab your popcorn, dim the lights, and get ready to immerse yourself in a world of lights, camera, and action. Hello there! Welcome back to Flick Fix, the very last episode of 2025. Ooh, I'm Austin, and we've got a fun lineup today. First, we're starting things off with Wicked for Good, the big finale that's wrapping up this reimagined Oz story. Then we jump straight into Guillermo del Toro's new gothic swing at Frankenstein, a fresh retelling of Mary Shelley's classic that's already stirring up conversation. And for this month's Spotlight Review, we're heading back to the early 2000s for Rat Race, the cross-country comedy mayhem film that proved the ensemble movie wasn't dead, just completely unhinged. Stick around, it's all coming up on Flick Fix. Wicked for Good, also known as Wicked Part 2, is John M. Chu's follow-up to last year's film, picking up right where the first installment left off, adapting more of the beloved 2003 Broadway musical by Stephen Schwartz and Winnie Holzman. Most of the original cast is back again, including Ariana Grande, Cynthia Erivo, Jonathan Bailey, Ethan Slater, Bowen Yang, Michelle Yeoh, and Jeff Goldblum. The plot is this. Now demonized as the Wicked Witch of the West, Elphaba lives in exile in the Ozian forest, while Glinda resides at the palace in Emerald City, reveling in the perks of fame and popularity. As an angry mob rises against the Wicked Witch, she'll need to reunite with Glinda to transform herself and all of Oz for good. Here's the thing you should probably know about me and my history with Wicked. I've never seen the stage production, and I've never read the book. So this entire story has basically been brand new territory for me. That said, I do genuinely love Broadway. I've seen quite a few shows over the past several years, and I've always walked away impressed. I love the energy, the music, the choreography, the whole spectacle of it. None of those shows happened to be Wicked, unfortunately, so I went into these movies as a total newcomer. When the first Wicked movie hit theaters last year, I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. I loved the way the film brought Oz to life, how it reimagined a world we all think we know so well, and made it feel vibrant and new again. The songs were upbeat and infectious. The characters popped off the screen, and the whole thing felt like a true cinematic translation of a Broadway show. In the best way possible, it felt big, colorful, and full of personality. Now, when I was chatting with some of my movie-going friends, a few of them were skeptical about the decision to split Wicked into two films. Personally, I didn't really have a strong opinion at first. I just figured, well, maybe they're treating it like a traditional performance. Act 1, intermission, Act 2. Made sense in my head. The first movie is the big opening half, then we get all the snacks, stretch our legs, and come back for the finale. But after watching Wicked for Good, I have to admit, the second half doesn't land quite as strongly as the first movie did. A big part of why, at least for me, comes down to the entire first half of this sequel. And honestly, I'll own some of this. I didn't rewatch the original before heading in, so maybe I set myself up for a bit of confusion. But even with that in mind, I don't think the film does a great job of easing the audience back into Oz. It doesn't really reorient you or guide you back into the world the way a sequel usually does. Instead, it kind of just says, alright, anyway, moving on, and immediately jumps into the story. Because of that, I found myself scrambling a little, reaching back into my memory, trying to recall certain plot points and character beats from the first film. And when you're doing mental homework instead of watching what's happening on the screen, the pacing really starts to feel off. A lot of people online have said that the movie feels slow, but for me, it was more disconnected. I was trying to catch up instead of being carried along. Another issue, mostly in the first half, is several major events, things that should feel huge, emotional, or dramatically important, are treated almost casually. They happen, the story nods to them, and then it just keeps moving. It sometimes felt like the emotional weight wasn't matching the scale of what was happening, which made the early sections feel oddly hollow. But don't worry, I've got some good news, some very good news. And that is, once the movie finally finds its momentum, everything starts clicking into place. The songs suddenly feel more meaningful, the emotional beats finally land, and I remembered why I wanted to see the sequel in the first place, to get a satisfying, genuine conclusion. When the film lets the music and the character arcs breathe, it becomes so much easier to settle in and feel what it's trying to communicate. A huge part of that lift comes from our two leads, Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo. Their chemistry is fantastic and they bring an enormous amount of heart and presence to every scene they share. And since I'm completely new to the Wicked universe, I had no idea what twists or revelations were coming. That made the overall concept of this story even more compelling for me. The idea of exploring the untold side of Wizard of Oz, giving depth and context to characters that we think we already know, it's such a clever angle. I love the way this world expands on the original material and reframes it into something fresh and emotionally rich. You can really see why the Broadway show and the book have meant so much to so many people. By the time the movie ended, I felt like I'd gone on my little own trip down the yellow brick road. A few bumps, a few dazzling sights, and at least one moment where I definitely questioned whether we were still in Kansas anymore. But even with its wobbly first act and a couple of flying monkey-sized pacing issues, Wicked for Good still managed to find its heart, its courage, and yes, even a bit of brain by the end. It may not soar quite as high as Act 1, but it lands on its ruby-slippered feet with enough charm to make the journey worthwhile. For me, this chapter in Oz earns a 6.5 out of 10. Not perfect, but there's still no place like the movie theater. Frankenstein is a 2025 gothic science fiction film produced, written, and directed by Guillermo del Toro, based on Mary Shelley's novel. Oscar Isaac takes on the tormented role of Victor Frankenstein, with Jacob Elordi portraying the creature. Mia Goth and Christoph Waltz round out the supporting cast. The story follows an ambitious, ego-driven scientist whose attempt to create life rebounds with devastating, often unexpected consequences. Guillermo del Toro has once again stepped into the world of classic literature. After giving us his haunting interpretations of Nightmare Alley and Pinocchio, he's now taken on Frankenstein. And honestly, if there's any modern filmmaker I trust to reimagine a beloved story without completely derailing it, it's Del Toro. He doesn't just adapt existing material, he resurrects it. He breathes new energy into these old narratives while stamping them with his unmistakable style and emotional depth. If you are familiar with Del Toro's sensibilities, you'll feel right at home here. Frankenstein is tailor-made for his love of gothic atmosphere, lavish production design, and just enough of the macabre to keep your skin crawling. Throughout this movie, I caught echoes of The Devil's Backbone, Crimson Peak, and even The Shape of Water, not in a derivative way, but in the sense that all the best hallmarks of his filmmaking are alive and well. And while the visuals are great, it's Del Toro's narrative choices that give this adaptation its personality. Instead of focusing solely on the doctor or the creature, the film splits its attention and lets both perspectives breathe. It's a smart approach that not only deepens the story, but helps keep this nearly 2.5 hour movie from ever dragging. In fact, I was genuinely shocked when I checked the runtime afterward. If anything, the pacing is one of the biggest strengths here. Performance-wise, there are a lot of good things happening here. Oscar Isaac gives a solid tortured soul performance as Victor, and Mia Goth brings her usual intensity to every scene she's in. But Jacob Elordi absolutely steals the show as the creature. What makes his work so impressive is how much he communicates with so little dialogue. He carries entire emotional beats through expression, posture, and silence. It's not necessarily Oscar bait material, but it's the kind of performance you walk away thinking about the next day, one that lingers in a good way. Now, if you've ever seen Del Toro's previous reinterpretations, especially Pinocchio, you already know he's not afraid to deviate from the source material. And predictably, the internet is buzzing with people nitpicking every tiny departure, comparing this film to both the 1931 version and the original novel. And sure, that's expected. It's Frankenstein after all. But personally, I enjoy seeing what new angles these famous stories can take. I like most of the choices Del Toro makes here. My biggest gripe, though, is that the central message feels a bit too spelled out. Like the film doesn't trust the audience to pick up on its themes. We all know the who's the real monster idea, but I'm not convinced the movie earns the emotional weight behind that question. The creature, I think, is too sympathetic this time, which softens the story's impact and makes the theme feel a little more surface level than it should. Still, even with that drawback, the film delivers plenty of emotional moments elsewhere. At the end of the day, Del Toro's Frankenstein may not have created perfection, but it's definitely far from the shambling, stitched-together mess some adaptations turn into. It has a real pulse, strong performances, gorgeous visuals, and enough emotion to keep the story's heart beating, even when a few bolts stick out. Sure, a couple of themes feel like they were delivered with the subtlety of a lightning strike, but when the film fires on all cylinders, it's alive! It's alive! I'm giving this monstrous experiment a solid 8 out of 10. Alright, don't go anywhere, because after the break, we're diving into this month's Spotlight review. The chaotic 2001 ensemble comedy, Rat Race. Fun fact, during filming, the cast actually had a hard time keeping straight faces because Rowan Atkinson kept improvising physical gags that weren't even in the script. So if you've ever wondered why everyone looks like they're about to crack up in half of his scenes, it's because they were. Stick around. You're listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW.
Programming like this is made possible by support from High Five Cannabis, your local cannabis connection, in Vancouver and Stevenson, Washington. High Five offers flower, concentrates, edibles, tinctures, topicals, and more. Whether you're new to cannabis or know what you need, their staff is available to assist. If you go to highfivecannabis.com, spelled H-I-G-H, the number 5, cannabis.com, you can learn about their specials like Munchy Monday, Senior Tuesdays, Waxy Wednesdays, and Loyalty Thursdays. Again, that's highfivecannabis.com. Oh, you know
it! KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years. Licensed in Washington State, our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at buckleylaw.net. Buckley & Associates, we speak your language.
우리는 여러분의 언어를 구사합니다.
我们说你的语言.
Nosotros hablamos tu idioma.
중도의 nói ngôn ngữ của bạn.
Support for KXRW comes from Kindred Vancouver in Uptown. Kindred is a community-focused general store offering bulk refillery options and supplies for sustainable do-it-yourself living. With a focus on reducing waste and supporting clean, mindful lifestyles, Kindred helps individuals incorporate low-impact choices into daily life. More information is available at kindredvancouver.com. That's K-I-N-D-R-E-D, Vancouver.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. When you rewind the clock back to the late 90s and early 2000s, Hollywood was in this weird transitional zone. The prestige dramas were starting to balloon in budget. The big tentpole franchises were slowly waking up. And comedy was in a full-blown identity crisis. You had the tail end of the slapstick era giving way to raunchy Farrelly Brothers comedies. Saturday Night Live alumni were getting their own vehicles left and right. And ensemble comedies, big, messy, star-stuffed productions, were becoming rare. Studios were terrified of them. Too expensive, too many egos, too many schedules to line up. And then, in 2001, out of nowhere, Paramount drops Rat Race, a revival of that classic, sprawling comedy style made famous decades earlier by It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And the connection is not subtle. In fact, Jerry Zucker, one-third of the legendary Zucker Abraham's Zucker team, said openly that he wanted to recreate that sense of absurd, frantic adventure comedy, but with a modern twist. Let's start the music and resume this story. Now, Zucker is a really interesting piece of this puzzle. Most people associate him with spoof movies. Airplane, Top Secret, The Naked Gun, but Zucker actually had something to prove by this point. He'd spent most of the 90s trying to move away from pure comedy, directing films like Ghost and First Night with Sean Connery, but Rat Race was him returning to comedy in a way that wasn't a spoof. It was character-based, plot-driven, and, this is rare for a big studio comedy, shot like an adventure film. Big stunts, helicopters, desert highways, real casinos, dozens of practical gags. The scale on this thing was massive. The cast is the other big selling point, and this is where the behind-the-scenes story gets fun. Paramount basically said, "Okay, Jerry, we're going old-school ensemble comedy? Fine, you can cast whoever you want." And he did. He pulled together one of the strangest, most delightful mixes of early 2000s talent imaginable. Rowan Atkinson, Whoopi Goldberg, John Lovitz, Seth Green, Cuba Gooding Jr., Amy Smart, Breckin Meyer, Kathy Najimy, Wayne Knight, John Cleese, Dave Thomas, the list goes on. But it's important to remember, this cast wasn't random. Every person in this movie was peaking or pivoting in their career. Rowan Atkinson was fresh off the continued global domination of Mr. Bean. Whoopi was in the middle of her talk show era and had just finished Girl Interrupted. Cuba Gooding Jr. was still riding the post-Jerry Maguire wave. Seth Green was becoming a household name thanks to Austin Powers and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Even Breckin Meyer was having a moment. He'd been in Clueless, Road Trip, and Can't Hardly Wait. Because of that, the chemistry on set was apparently wild. Everyone came in with a different comedic style. You had physical comedians, improv people, sketch comedians, Oscar winners, sitcom stars, and Zucker had to wrangle all of it into one cohesive tone. But from every interview I've seen, it sounds like the energy on set was pure chaos in the best way. One producer said that directing this movie felt like, quote, trying to conduct an orchestra made of feral cats, but in a loving way. Another big part of that chaos was the stunts. While Rat Race might feel like broad comedy, it was actually a huge physical production. That helicopter sequence? Almost entirely practical. Amy Smart trained with flight instructors and spent weeks in a real helicopter with stunt pilots. The cow hanging from the chopper? Practical. The rocket car? Practical. The hot air balloon scenes? Yep, again, practical. They actually shot in the desert with multiple balloons, crews, and chase vehicles. And another big production challenge, Rowan Atkinson. Not because he was difficult, he was the opposite, but because he absolutely refused to half commit to physical comedy. Zucker said Rowan kept inventing new ways to trip, fall, collapse, or contort his body in scenes. At one point, the stunt team told him to maybe dial it back before you break something. He said no. He also improvised a ton of his narcoleptic bits. Zucker said working with him felt like having access to Buster Keaton's brain. And then there's the villain of this movie, John Cleese. This was one of the first times in his later career where he leaned into playing a full eccentric billionaire caricature. Cleese apparently had some input in his wardrobe, telling the costume team he wanted to dress like Colonel Sanders if Colonel Sanders was also a Bond villain. The teeth? His idea. Production took place mostly in Las Vegas, Calgary, and southern Alberta. So yes, this is weirdly a Canadian-American co-production. And shooting in Vegas at the time was tricky. The casinos wanted the exposure, but not too much exposure. There were all kinds of rules about where the cameras could point, which tables could be shown, which slot machines had licensing restrictions, and what their fictional casino was allowed to imitate. A lot of the casino interiors were rebuilt on sound stages just to work around all of the red tape. And now, here's something a lot of people don't know. Rat Race has a real humanitarian angle behind the scenes. The Smash Mouth concert finale, a moment that lives permanently in 2000s pop culture, was actually tied to a charity event. Paramount held a massive real-life fundraiser for the Special Olympics during production, and the set was full of athletes and families. Zucker has said many times that the movie's message, helping others, being decent, choosing generosity over greed, is the part he's most proud of. After production wrapped, Rat Race was released on August 17, 2001, closing out the summer movie season. It performed respectably at the box office, opening just under $12 million and finishing with around $85 million worldwide. Not a smash hit, but solid enough to more than pay for itself, especially once home video arrived. And that brings me to my own history with the film. When I first saw Rat Race, I was just starting middle school. I didn't catch it in theaters. I discovered it the old-fashioned way, at Blockbuster. I remember seeing the commercials, thinking it looked chaotic and edgy, and renting it purely off that energy. And at that age, when you're just beginning to find edgy humor absolutely hilarious for reasons you can't even explain, it totally worked on me. I remember watching it, laughing a lot, and then moving on with my life. But Rat Race always stayed in this strange little corner of my memory. Not a favorite, not something I rewatched every year, but one of those odd early 2000s comedies that stuck around like a weird relic from childhood. So when I picked it as this month's Spotlight review, I figured it was finally time to revisit it, this time with an older, supposedly wiser brain. And I've got to be honest, watching it now, it's really not that funny. Which makes me kind of sad because I wanted that nostalgic spark to be there. Instead, what stood out most was how much of the humor feels like it's trying way too hard. This is a Jerry Zucker film, and I kept comparing it to Airplane, which is still hilarious decades later, and I found myself wondering, why does Airplane hold up so well when Rat Race, made almost 20 years later, doesn't? And I think I might have figured it out. Rat Race leans heavy into this early 2000s PG-13 edginess. Innuendo, sex jokes, the kind of wink-wink adults will get this humor that feels more desperate than clever. The very first hotel scene is a perfect example. The clerk keeps repeating the name of an adult video over and over, as if saying it again will magically make it funny. It doesn't. And the problem is, a lot of the jokes in this movie follow that same formula, repetition instead of wit. Compare that with Airplane, layered visual gags, sharp wordplay, clever running jokes, punchlines that catch you off guard. Airplane feels effortless. Rat Race often feels like it's trying to keep up with the raunchier comedies of the era without fully committing, which leaves it stuck in the middle. And then beyond the trying too hard humor, there's the stuff that definitely hasn't aged well at all. There are jokes rooted in transphobia, jokes about mental illness, things that land with a thud now. Definitely a few yikes moments. But here's the flip side. I was still entertained, not really by the jokes themselves, but by the situations. And that's where the movie shines for me. The chaos of the car chases, the helicopter insanity, the cow hanging from the chopper, the rocket car, the mismatched teams accidentally barreling through increased absurd scenarios. That old school everything goes comedy spirit is where Rat Race is at its best. And everyone in the cast looks like they're genuinely having the time of their lives. Even when a joke doesn't land, the energy is infectious. It seems like it must have been incredibly fun to make. And then there's that ending, the Smash Mouth concert. If there's anything that cements this movie as a time capsule, it's that. Between this, Shrek, Mystery Men, and probably some others I'm forgetting, Smash Mouth absolutely dominated late 90s and early 2000s movie culture. Rest in peace to Steve Harwell. But man, like, this was truly their era. So, overall, Rat Race was okay. I had fun revisiting it, but it's definitely aged unevenly. Half of it is wild, nostalgic chaos in a good way, and the other half is humor that no longer lands the way it used to. It's a mixed bag. You know, it didn't fully recapture the magic I'd hoped, but you know what? It's still something that was really intriguing to me. A last hurrah for big, practical, ensemble-driven chaos before the genre shifted in a different direction. It's messy, loud, occasionally misguided, but always sincere in its attempt to entertain. And even if it doesn't hit the same today, there's something endearing about watching a film swing big with this much enthusiasm. For all its flaws and all its energy, Rat Race remains a fascinating little time capsule worth revisiting, even if just to see how far comedy has evolved since. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Flick Fix. Today we covered a lot of ground, from the long-awaited finale of Wicked for Good, to Guillermo del Toro's bold new take on Frankenstein, and of course our spotlight review took us back to the early 2000s with Rat Race. If you enjoy Flick Fix and want to support the station that makes it possible, you can donate anytime at kxrw.fm. Just keep scrolling down until you see that donate button. Every contribution helps keep independent community radio alive and running right here in Vancouver. You've been listening to Flick Fix on 99.9 KXRW. I'm Austin, and until next time, may your popcorn stay fresh, your movies stay weird, and may your cross-country road trips involve far fewer hijinks.